Hey, podcast listeners, a few years ago, well, when the station moved from Uppsala College to Jersey City, we bought this big building, and on the first floor of the building was a real estate office. And as their business got worse and worse, at first they kind of bargained with us. They kind of paid half the rent and only used half the space and half the parking places. And then eventually it was like one desk. And then eventually they kind of went out of business. So we didn't know what to do with that ground floor space. And eventually we've turned it into something called Monty Hall, as our building is on Montgomery Street. So our music hall is called Monty Hall. And we're using it now to present films and live music performances and all kinds of any kind of performance, really. And it's really interesting. It's small. It's intimate. The sound is good. We can video things and put them up on the web. It's awesome. And there's a showing this Friday of this documentary about Boyce and Hart. And that is why Bobby Hart is calling in today. You may remember in March of 2014, just about a year ago, I spoke at length all about Bobby Hart and his life. So I'm not rerunning that one here. This is a shorter interview. We cover a few things we didn't cover that first time. And there are things that I learned reading his new book. You'll hear about that during the interview. And then just as a podcast bonus, after this Bobby Hart interview is over, you'll hear my Mickey Dolenz interview from 2012. It's also not that old, but you can turn it off if you've already heard it. So we'll hear from Bobby Hart from just this week. And then you'll hear the introduction to the Mickey Dolenz, the original introduction to the original time I aired the Mickey Dolenz podcast from 2012. And if you're still interested, you can go to WFMU.org/Michael and listen to my March 2014 Bobby Hart interview. I think that's clear. Thanks for listening. Hope you're doing well and talk to you soon.
Let's sit and talk about each other's feelings tonight. Something on your mind has got you uptight. So I'll tell you my story. You tell me your story. It's gonna work out alright. 'Cause I'm digging you, and you're digging me. I'm digging you, digging me.
Change at the end, you know. You gotta have, it's like, this is why I love these records, because they're kitchen sink, you know. There's like whatever stop can be pulled out to put more hooks into the song will be used. And you know, these records are just, they just don't make records like this anymore. Of course, Boyce and Hart there, and Bobby Hart joins us on the telephone. Welcome back to the program, and good morning, Bobby Hart.
Good morning,
how are
you? Michael, great to be here.
You've got a brand new book just came out called Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. And you've got this movie out, which is screening right here at WFMU's Monty Hall on Friday. Boyce and Hart, the guys who wrote them. There's a lot going on, but it started so early. The book tells... I'm going to let you talk soon. Don't worry. The book tells this amazing story of this kid from a small town trying to distinguish himself, literally dropped off at the corner of Hollywood and Vine at age 18 with $50. And this is the part that kind of gets me, with really no connections. You know, you're making records, just a couple months almost after that. It's an amazing story.
I didn't even have the dream when I got dropped off on the corner. I thought I was coming to go to disc jockey school and be like you, but I got sidetracked within a couple of months by a little sign on the recording studio that said, come in and see what your voice sounds like. Not your voice, your voice. And I all of a sudden shifted and decided, hey, I can be a rock and roll star.
Well, we heard that song earlier, Too Many Teardrops, one of your earlier works.
Oh.
But it's such a, you know, such a, again, a full production, and, you know, there's backgrounds, and there's that melodica, I think it's a melodica on there, and
yeah.
It's a big record. I mean, you can tell, was everybody just going for it in L.A. at that time? I mean, it seems like rock and roll was still sort of this new thing, and nobody knew how to grab the brass ring, sort of.
It was the infancy of rock and roll, and it was a big change because there had been like three or four record companies. That was it, just like it is now. And then when rock and roll came in, everybody and their brother started a little independent label, and they'd do great until they had a hit, and then they'd spend all this money to press the records, and then distributors wouldn't pay them, and they'd go out of business. Somebody else would pop up in the same spot.
You spoke with Joe Bielock earlier in the week, and
yeah.
Folks can check the archives for that. And you and I spoke at length just a couple of years ago.
Yep.
When the first cut of this movie was playing, and now it's the final cut, and like I said, it's playing Friday at Monty Hall, and I think it will sell out, and I advise folks to get tickets right now, and there's a link on the WFMU.org page where they can buy tickets for that.
Come out and see it. It's the only opportunity to see it. It's not released yet. It's just a preview for you guys.
And you'll be there answering questions and stuff like that, and maybe signing some
records. I'll be signing some books that night, so come down and grab a copy of a Psychedelic Bubblegum.
Yeah, it's a really interesting record, and it's a book, and it's one of those books where you don't really hold back, although I have to say there's not too much. You're one of the few guys who did not go drug crazy or drink crazy. I think in the whole book you take one tablet of drugs and have one alcoholic drink in the entire book.
Thank God. You know, some of our contemporaries didn't make it through those troubled waters, and I just feel fortunate.
I mean, you were the only sober guy in the room a lot of the time, especially with the Monkees. I think, you know, it's a
the Monkees are still standing, except for Davey, God bless him, and it wasn't because of drugs.
Yeah,
he left us.
Yeah, you talk about your work with the Monkees. Mike Nesmith comes off as not a jerk, but as like sort of a jerk. I don't know.
Your words, not mine.
Yes, they're my. Yeah, you don't say that. But he comes off as a guy who needs to kind of put his needle in everything, even when it's against his own best interest. Like he can't help himself.
Well, you know, I don't blame him. There was two guys, two actors who had learned how to become musicians, two musicians who had learned how to become actors. He was one of the musicians, and he wanted to have more of a say about the music, and of course it wasn't set up that way.
Yeah.
So it was a little pushback from the beginning.
The book tells sort of the struggle, the many struggles over the Monkees music, and one thing that I did not know was that you guys wrote these great songs, but I guess it's Don Kirshner felt like you just hadn't earned your producer stripes, so he actually got Mickey Most to try to record some Monkey stuff, and he got Snuff Garrett to try to do it, and he got Goffin and King to try to do it, and they all literally made recordings that just didn't work, and they finally went back to you guys. I had no idea of that stuff, because all those three teams of people have made some amazing pop records.
They had. They were great. They were the greatest record producers of our day at that time. The difference was that we'd been working on the project for almost a year, and we had thought of nothing else, eating and sleeping the Monkees' new project and what it should sound like and what it should look like, and stocking songs, getting ready. And then when he took us off the project, it was devastating, but we hung in.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, they had to come crawling back to you. There is something in, you know, I've been listening to a lot of the Boyce and Hart records, and in some ways they are better produced than the Monkees. There's like a, you know, there's just such a, they're so arranged. You know, there's all these dynamics in the record and all these instruments coming in and out and parts and vocal parts, you know, and it sounds like this is really sort of what the Monkees could have been if you guys could have made all of the decisions. You know, it kind of gives me an insight as to what's missing almost from the Monkees records.
Tommy and I were learning on the job. You know, we learned from doing demo records, and we got pretty good, and then we got our big break with the Monkees, and by the time we were doing Boyce and Hart, doing ourselves as artists, maybe we were getting a little better, owning our craft.
Yeah, there's amazing records like that one we just heard, just so huge, and they're huge in a way that records just aren't today. They're great. One of the thing, you know, you got married real young to your high school sweetheart, you had two kids, and you were juggling all these things. And one of the things I did not know about your past at all that I learned in this book, Psychedelic Bubblegum, is that you worked in Vegas with Teddy Randazzo, and you worked in sort of the clubs in L.A. and in the Valley during that sort of, you know, the Johnny Rivers model of play from, you know, whatever, 9 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Exactly.
And, I mean, what was that like? I mean, that, you know, you have this idea that it was just the most electric thing ever with the girls and the go-go and everybody, the teenagers, claiming their culture. What was those sets like?
Yeah, it was that time. Everything was shifting in L.A. especially was the forefront of it. The West Coast in particular, and it was great times with the twist craze and then with the harder music was starting to come in with the Doors and the Leaves and those guys. It was fun times, and I thought, well, this is what show business is all about. But I soon realized that I could play those clubs the rest of my life and still be looking for my next paycheck the following week to pay the rent. And Tommy was right to convince me to come back to New York, back from New York to and off the road, and join him at Screen Gems and write songs.
You had written some. You had co-written and written some hits, and you'd made your own records, and you had some publishing deals where you were making like $50 a month or $100 a month, and so I guess going out and working, you have two kids, you got to go out there and work. You mostly played the B3, the Hammond organ. So how many songs in a night would you play? How many different songs?
Well, like you said, we did 5 hours, and so in an hour, we'd get 10 or 15 minutes off during each hour, take a break for the cause, you know, pause for the cause. We had all the wraps down, you know, and so I suppose that we must have played about 12 or 14 songs every hour. So I don't know, to add it up, I guess.
Yeah, do you have any recordings of those days? Because you know,
I remember a guy who scout from a record company came in one night, and he said, "Oh, this sounds good. Let me just bring my tape recorder in." And so when he brings the recorder in, our guitar player says, "I'm not going to play this set. I can't just record my licks."
He didn't want to have his licks stolen?
He took his recorder back out to the car.
Oh, my God. That's interesting. I mean, because I guess in some ways it did seem so disposable. You're playing 5 hours a night. How precious can it be? But I'd love to hear one, you know, you were there type of moment.
Well, we kind of, because we did get those one-off record single releases, and there are some of those things out there that we did with the band. I basically had the same band Teddy's band. That Teddy Randazzo, and we'd play 12 weeks on, 12 weeks off in Vegas and other places. And when we weren't working with him in between, we'd come to L.A. and we'd work as a quartet with me singing and playing the organ.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, in this book, is that you are a hard worker. You know, I mean, that's part of it. You know, you just worked a lot. You didn't say no a lot, and you tried to fulfill what people needed. And, you know, you're in L.A. where people need music for stuff all the time, like the Days of Our Lives theme, which was on the air for 50 years, you know, which
still going. Knock on wood.
Amazing. So how does publishing work? Let's just talk about that briefly. You write a song and you get paid for 50 years. Is that how it works?
Well, you get paid from a couple of sources. One is for every record that sells. Now, these days, of course, everybody thinks music should be free, and hardly are records selling. And so it's not the same. But in those days, it's a statutory rate set by Congress. And in those days, we were getting a penny, and that penny would be split half to the publisher, and then half a penny would go split between the writers.
Wow.
And then, but the second way is you get paid from what they call performance rights organizations, and they pay, they collect money every time a record's played on television or in the movies. And then the third source is if you get it in a movie, then that's a sync fee, and that's like a lump sum thing, a movie or a commercial, and that's that comes in handy. Nice.
And your records really are part of that soundtrack of the 60s, so whenever anybody wants to make a movie taking place in the 60s, you know, there's a lot of co-writes of yours in being used today, you know?
We get those wonderful surprises from time to time. In fact, the new Disney Nature movie called Monkey Kingdom is out, and they use the monkey's theme, not only in the... They paid more, actually, to use it in the trailer for the movie, but they also used it in the opening of the movie.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, it's a great... I mean, is the catchiest song ever written, perhaps? So.
Yeah, it probably is the most lucrative song, yeah. Other than Days of Our Lives, which plays 5 days a week, and that's National Network TV, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's... Oh, that's amazing, yeah. At one point in the book, you say that Boys in Heart... You became a runaway train. Sort of, you stopped working with the monkeys, and you guys decided, let's do our own thing for real. And then you say it became a runaway train quickly. What happened?
Well, I think any group that gets really popular quickly, it goes through this. But we were doing not only records for other people producing, but we were producing our own records, going on the road, doing the concerts, doing the press, doing the interviews, doing the sound checks, doing the... You know, it's just... It becomes... a whirl in your mind, and you just, after a while, it takes a toll on the nervous system. I think there's a famous quote by George Harrison who said that the fans gave us their love and we gave them our nervous system. I mean, that's what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I can sort of imagine. Let me remind folks that we're talking to Bobby Hart here, author of this new book called Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boys in Heart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. And he'll also be right here at WFMU's Monty Hall this Friday for a screening of Boys in Heart, the guys who wrote him, along with, I believe, the director, and Joe Bielak will be there, and we'll be answering some questions from folks. So I recommend...
Come out. It'll be a fun night.
Yeah, absolutely. You did this... There's a great chapter in the book, again, something I didn't know, and I'm leaving out huge swaths of the book because I think folks will really enjoy reading it, where you find a new, very dynamic manager, and you're told by people you trust, don't work with this guy.
Yeah.
It won't work out.
Yeah.
And he steals all your money. I mean, it's like the textbook. He actually sort of delivers in the beginning.
Oh, he delivered great.
Amazing.
He made deals
yeah.
that nobody else could have made, including the people that were warning us not to go with him. And we had a great run with him for about a year and a half. And he had more, you know, intricate visions for our careers than even we did. And he took us to places we never would have gone. So there's no regrets. We knew what we were getting into. But, of course, when he got us the gig to open in the main room, Flamingo Hotel in Vegas, with Zsa Zsa Gabor, that was pretty cool. But then he had this little gambling thing. So
yeah, well, it's very interesting because you're at this sort of turning point where you are now superstars, and you have a very critically successful week in Vegas, and you're about to extend that. And then this guy steals your money, and your partner Tommy says, "That's it, I can't take it." And the runaway train sort of goes off the tracks at that time.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the real loss was you know, breaking up the partnership. And of course, the friendship survived, but it was a little rough just. Pulling the brake on the speeding train, like you said.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you worked immediately. You kept working, and you
yeah.
sort of over and over again in this book, you sort of put it all back together. You start working with the Partridge Family, and
right.
You know, all kinds of things. There's this book is not just a show business book. It is also a book about your search for enlightenment and your search for happiness and your search for just. To be calm, and there's little breaks in between some of the chapters, the stepping stones through the potholes of life, in which I can see that you're really trying hard to give practical, useful tips without, you know, beating anybody over the head with religion or some of the deeper things.
Yeah, I wanted to show, you know, it became almost an obligation. You start to see when you're writing, you don't notice while you're going through it and living your life, but when you look back on it, and you see these patterns. What I could have done better, what things worked for me. So I really felt, hey, I need to share this with others, anybody who can learn from my mistakes and learn from what I did right. So we did the little stepping stone pages, and shared my spiritual journey. It's not going to be, everyone has their own unique journey, but there are some parallels. And so, you know, my life was saved when I met Paramahansa Yogananda, my guru, and that was just a turning point for me. And meditation has been the way for me. It may not be for everyone, but it's at least I'm putting it out there.
And is that a daily practice for you?
Yeah, yoga has just, you know, saved my life. That's how the nervous system survived.
That's quite a testimony. And it seems like yoga has helped you focus. I mean, focus, I think, is really one of the words in the book that...
It's true. Concentration is so important. Perseverance, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, you got to keep... Once you find your dream, you want to fine-tune it as you go along, but you want to keep doing it until it materializes. And that door, that opportunity will open at some point, but you've got to be ready. You can't just say, oh, here it is, I'd like to do this. No, you got to be working at it.
Do you still write songs now?
Yeah, I still write, not as prolific as before, because we were working on this on Psychedelic Bubblegum for 6 years with my co-writer, Glenn Ballantyne, and that's been taking our time now promoting it. So that's our focus now, plus we're going to be going out and doing some seminars and keynote speeches, kind of talking about those things that you've just been mentioning.
One of the things in the book that's quite interesting is you talk about how you and Tommy would write songs, and literally you would write them walking down the street or sitting in the park or, you know, in a car on the way to pitch.
Yeah.
You know, it was really it sounds like having a co-writer in those situations is really important.
Well, a lot of people, you know, most of the East Coast writers that we were our contemporaries at that time, one wrote music, one wrote lyrics. We had the advantage that we both wrote both. So our reason for being together was the fun we had, you know, so why not take advantage of it? And when we got signed to Screen Gems Columbia Music and came back to California, you know, they were giving us $100 a week. Well, that was great. That paid our rent. We didn't have to worry about the day gig anymore. And so we were having a ball and being, I think that contributed to our creativity as well.
Are there songs that are for you personal milestones where along the way you said, you know, this song is a giant step forward, it's not a baby step forward, it's something that really, you know, sometimes you just sort of get handed almost mystically a giant step forward. Are there songs that kind of...
Well, I think the ones we've talked about, I think in the Last Train to Clarksville, when the first Monkey single that was zooming up the charts before the show even went on the air, Days of Our Lives, which has been so lasting, and songs like I Want to Be Free, which got recorded by so many other people, that was kind of a meaningful song to us because it was one of the few that we wrote just because we felt like it one night, and not as short order cooks as I used to call ourselves. Or a project that was coming up.
Yeah, it is very interesting because in the book there's a lot of descriptions of folks say, we need a song like this, kid. And you always say we have one, and then you write it after the after the fact. You know?
Well, Tommy Boyce was the consummate salesman, you know, so besides the fun that he was to work with and to be a friend of, he was a great salesman, and that was part of his style.
Yeah, yeah. Never say no. I guess that helps. You know, one of the few things you don't really talk about in the book is how Tommy ended his. He took his own life, and was it just something you just couldn't go there?
I allude to it because I don't want people just assume, well, he was depressed. I don't think he was depressed. He had had a medical thing, you know, an aneurysm in his brain that broke, and he never got his energy back from that. And they told him it's inevitable this will happen again. You'll probably be a vegetable. And so, of course, there's no excuse for that, you know, but it's kind of an understanding that can come with that.
Yeah, so it's very heartbreaking, and for people close to him, I'm sure it was, it was. Devastating. Yeah. Ugh. Well, it's a really interesting book, and like I said, you know, just your honesty and that stuff should be applauded. I've read a lot of these books where people don't tell what really happened, and in this book, sort of seems like you're actually telling what really happened, but gently and you know, not in a sensational way, and so you get points for that. It's called Psychedelic Bubblegum, Boyce and Hart, The Monkees, and Turning Mayhem into Miracles. And Bobby will be at WFMU with copies of the book this Friday night, showing the movie. And like I said, I think folks should. It's a pretty small place with the seats, and it probably will sell out. And I recommend folks get tickets right now over at WFMU.org. It's super interesting book, super interesting guy, and written so many songs. I mean, when you get into the, like you said, the I Want to Be Free, you know, like 100 people, including, crooners, you know, people who are serious singers who sing the American songbook, that song. You know, there's so many people, the Monkees and Fats Domino and Paul Revere and the Standells and Del Shannon and Jane and the Americans and Chubby Checker and Little Anthony and Gary Luce, just, you know, and the list goes on and on. It's amazing. It really is kind of mind boggling. Is your mind blown?
Well, I'm just appreciative, and I look back and just to see, you know, how things transpired. And like you said, a kid comes here, nothing in his pocket, and no contacts, and just hanging in those 6 years and learning my craft, and then to see, look back on it all, it is pretty mind-boggling even to me.
but you seem to have your feet mostly on the ground, which is... Which is good. I've got this song queued up now called Girl, I'm Out to Get You. It's one of my favorite Boyz II Heart tracks. Tell me how, you know, do you remember how it was written, how it was recorded, anything about it?
You know, this was part of what we were doing, and we've talked about it. We would go off and write these songs. Oftentimes, they were for projects. You know, Jane and the Americans is coming up 2 weeks from now, and they need a song where we'd write something that sounded like Jane and the Americans. But when we got to the Monkees and then Boyz II Heart, we were pretty much just writing from our hearts and whatever was on our mind at that time.
It's kind of interesting to go full 180 from, you know, what you said, short order cooks, to trying to express yourself and send your own message out there. Yeah. And so do we know who's playing on this record? Is it your regular band?
Yeah, our band, but like I said, it was Teddy's band. It was Jerry McGee and the Cajuns. The Cajuns were Larry Taylor, who later became a founding member of Canned Heat, and then Billy Lewis on drums, who was a great studio player. But when we got the Monkees project, these guys had just come back to town, so they had been in New York after working with Teddy, and we decided, hey, let's have a real band, a band that we've worked with in clubs and other venues for a couple of years now, and it's going to sound like a band, like a garage band, instead of the great session players, which we used on almost all the other projects. But when we did Boyz II Heart and we did the Monkees, it was the Candy Store Prophets, which formerly was Jerry McGee and the Cajuns.
Yeah, and Jerry McGee was in the Ventures for years and years. Just an amazing sort of when people sort of reel off that list of session guitar players from L.A., they usually don't list him, and he's mind-blowing. Yeah.
Oh, he's a great guitar player. And then for the Monkees, for our projects, we added Louis Sheldon, who went on to produce a ton of records for Seals and Croft and just became a great studio sought-after guy after we had brought him in for the Monkees. And a guy named Wayne Irwin, because we were looking for somebody who could do feedback guitar and some of those psychedelic licks.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that a lot of those Monkees records have three guitars on them, yet everybody's playing a part, and it doesn't sound like a cacophony. You know, it's
we would go in a little rehearsal studios and rehearse these things, work out the arrangements before we'd go in the expensive studios, and we treated it like a band.
Yeah. Great stuff. Let's hear Girl, I'm Out to Get You. Bobby Hart, thanks for taking a little bit of your morning to speak with us again. And I want to remind folks they've got archives of our longer conversation over at WFMU.org/Michael. And Joe Belock's got an archive of his conversation this week. Or you can have your own conversation with Bobby this Friday night at Monty Hall and pick up a copy of the new book. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michael, it's been a pleasure. And see everybody Friday night.
It's great. Thanks so much.
I shan't forget the day we met, my boat upset and I got wet. She offered me her blanket and some tea.
Hey!
Say, is that your clarinet? I bet we'd make a fine duet. Do you know Mozart's minuet in G? Maybe I could see you socially. Come with me back to my flat, it's late and I must feed my cat. With that she smiled and tied her hat to leave.
Hey!
On my Chinese mat we sat, commenced to chat of this and that. And then I tried to kiss her tenderly. And we began to my room like red balloons. The afternoon was spinning tunes that sent the rhythm to my head. And just this afternoon you pulled me from a dark lagoon and changed this tomb into a drawing room instead. I'm afraid I'm in above my head.
Great Boys and Heart. Those records really are special records. Like I said, just the dynamics in them and the arrangement and the just the creativity, I guess, is what it comes down to. There's just a lot of creative, great ideas in every one of those records. And, it, you know, it goes back a little bit to, I think they were definitely making albums. So last night, I'm just really getting ready for the final bit of my research for the Mickey Dolenz interview. And I get an email from the publicist saying, I just want to let you know that this interview must be 50% about Mickey Dolenz' new album. You know, and I've gotten this kind of email before, and so I emailed back saying, you know, I just can't do that. I cannot. My audience does not want to hear 15 minutes about Mickey Dolenz' new album. I said, I'll mention it. I'll play some songs from it. It's a fine, you know, it's not an embarrassing project. It's just not what I do here. I don't have guests on so they can promo their new record, which is why I do a show here on WFMU and not somewhere else where I'd be forced to obey a publicist's commands. Anyway, I just thought you might want to know. I appreciate doing my show here and not somewhere else. So here is briefly touching on his new album and bookended by songs from his new album. Here's Mickey Dolenz.
Watching the skirts, you start to float. Now you're in gear. Show, I hope she goes. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, there is Mickey Dolenz from the brand new CD, which is called Remember. Mickey Dolenz, welcome to the program. Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm great. Thank you so much for playing that cut.
Ah, you're welcome. You are a busy guy. You've always been a busy guy. You had a show last night at BB King's, and I understand it was recorded for perhaps a live album or something. Is that right?
Live CD, yep.
You're a busy guy. The Monkees start a new tour in November. It ends right here in New York City at the Beacon Theater on December 2nd, but I want to start at the beginning, not at the end. 1956. So your parents were in show business. Your dad was an actor. He's been in a million old TV shows. Your mom was a singer, I think. 1956, you're 10 or 11. You're in a TV show called Circus Boy for 3 years. Your whole life has been in show business. You're still in show business today. You're still doing gigs. Does it get tiring? Is it in your blood?
Good question. I don't know what else to do. as you say, I was in it. My first screen test, I was 6 years old, and I also have some prenatal work coming out on ultrasound.
Oh, terrific! Yes, you're real.
Yeah, right. I just don't really know anything else, to be honest. I had the one time I made a career choice, I suppose, was after high school. I'd already done the series, and my parents wisely had taken me out of the business for those formative high school years. But after high school, I started doing some guest shots on TV, and my friend of mine said, you know, we should really get serious about a career and a life. So I started studying to be an architect, and I went to university to college to be an architect. Hmm. And I was going to be an architect, and if I couldn't make it as an architect, I was going to fall back on show business. And then I was in school when the Monkee audition came along, and I wasn't a fool. I knew the power of a television and a series, of course. So I got out of school for about 10 days to do the pilot, but then I went back to school because I knew then, of course, that pilots don't always sell. So I went back to school, and then when they did finally say we sold the pilot and we got an order for 26 episodes, that's when I quit school.
Right before the Monkees, at some point you sort of had your own bands. I think not everybody knows you played. Yeah. You were sort of a guitar player, singer in a rock band in your teen years just before the Monkees. What were those bands like? Where did they play? What kind of sets did they do?
It was cover band, you know, like everyone was doing back at the time. It was a cover band. There was one called Mickey and the One-Nighters, and there was another one called the Missing Links, ironically enough. And they were cover bands. You know, we played clubs or played, you know, bar mitzvahs and cocktail lounges at bowling alleys, you know, doing the hits of the day.
Yeah.
One of my party pieces, one of my little party pieces was Johnny B. Goode, the Chuck Berry tune.
Yeah.
And I still do it to this day. And the reason I do it is because it was my audition piece for the Monkees. And that's the song that got me the gig. And on the album Remember, if you get a chance, listen, because I do a quite different version that I came up with to that wonderful old Chuck Berry tune. But yeah, I was in a couple of bands, and when I auditioned for the Monkees, well, you had to be able to sing and play to get through the auditions. And acting and improvising and some movement and some, you know, scene study and screen tests, and it was quite involved. And that was my audition piece, Johnny B. Goode. And I was a guitar player, yeah, a rhythm guitar player. And then they cast me and they said, okay, you're the drummer. I said, okay, where do I start? Similar to what I had done in Circus Boy when I did that series, they said, you're going to ride an elephant. And I said, okay, where do I start? Then I studied. I studied very hard as soon as the show was sold. I started studying. And I wasn't starting from square one because I was a musician. I had played Spanish guitar. Actually, classical guitar was my first foray into music. My father got me into that when I was like, oh, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old, playing, you know, Spanish guitar, Segovia and Villalobos and stuff like Villalobos and stuff like that. And then I would start going to parties and bring my guitar and in high school. And I noticed that the girls liked Kingston Trio better than Segovia. So I started playing, you know, Tom Dooley and stuff like that. And then the folk music sort of morphed into the rock and roll.
Yeah, people forget how huge the Kingston Trio really were, a giant band in American, you know, pre-Beatles, of course, and then it was Who, yeah. The Monkees, around 1966, you mentioned the audition, and I put on the playlist on the webpage for today's program, there's a YouTube video, it's about 20 minutes long, of screen test from the Monkees, and you guys, some of it is the guys just asking you questions, and you're talking, and then some of it you're doing some scenes and horsing around, and it's very interesting, because there's eight guys, and you kind of work with, and the other guys are squares. And it's so obvious that the four that they picked were the exact right four. There was something, you know, shooting out of you guys, youth and bubbling. And I always wonder, there's this idea that, especially in the plot of the Monkees episodes, often the Monkees are seen as misunderstood youth against the old people who are trying to keep the youth down. Is that something you felt at the time? Was that a palpable thing, this idea of, you know, the older generation just doesn't understand what's going on?
Oh, you mean off the set, not on the show?
Yeah. Well, did it work?
Well, there was that going on, but, you know, to be frank, that happens, I think, probably in every generation. If you were to ask 18, 20-year-old kids today, do your parents understand you? Does the society understand you? They would probably say no. I mean, that's quite typical, I think, of every generation going back a couple of million years.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, so the Monkees, amongst other, you know, the music of the time, but you know that goes back to, excuse me, that goes back to Elvis Presley, certainly before the Monkees. I mean, goodness, he was censored because of his him speaking to his generation, Frank Sinatra before that. I mean, every generation comes up against the older generation. You come up against your parents. It's almost biological that happens.
Yeah, you must sort of revolt a little bit. It's sort of healthy. Yeah. You sort of became the de facto lead singer. I mean, everybody sang lead, especially you and Davey, but you became sort of the most identified voice of the Monkees. And I think there is something about, I don't know, the timbre of your voice. I don't know the technical term. It just sounds great coming out of the radio. I'm assuming when they cast everybody, that hadn't been decided until you started to go into the recording studio and figure out who would sing these great songs.
That's a great observation, and frankly, I don't know exactly how it happened. I have a feeling that it was a little more by default. First of all, like I said, everybody did have to sing and play to get through the auditions, and each one of us had and still does have a very, very distinct style. Mike Nesmith, for instance, great songwriter, obviously still did and still has a sort of country rock flavor. Peter was really into folk music and the blues. David, of course, had done Broadway, Oliver, and definitely had that sort of Tony Newley Broadway sound. And I was a screaming rock and roller. If you listen to some of the stuff that I recorded pre-Monkees, if you ever get a chance, there's a couple of songs, one called Don't Do It and one called Huff Puff. That was before the Monkees. With Glenn Campbell playing guitar.
Wow.
As part of the Wrecking Crew. I was a screaming rock and roller, and I think that the producers, early on, as you know the story, we had little or no control over anything to do with the music, and the producers and the publishers would pick the tunes, and they're great tunes, don't get me wrong, you know, Clarksville and Stepping Stone and I'm a Believer and Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Yeah,
I mean, these were all incredible tunes written by incredible songwriters. But I distinctly remember that occasionally, more than occasionally, frequently, I would do a vocal on a song, and Davey would do a vocal on a song, and then sometimes Mike would do a vocal on the same song.
Mm.
And then I guess somebody up in some office building, you know, on off Sunset Boulevard, would sort of just pick the lead vocal that they thought would resonate and would sell copies, and it did end up more often than not being me. I'm very grateful for that, but I'm not. But that's the only explanation I can give you.
Yeah, very interesting. That when the first Monkees record came out, the album spent 13 weeks at number one, stayed on the Billboard chart for 78 weeks. Pretty amazing. I think the first four LPs, the first five LPs, I think, were all top 10. Of course, I think Last Train to Clarksville was a number one record. I'm a Believer, number one. A Little Bit You, A Little Bit Me, number two. Pleasant Valley Sunday was number three. Daydream Believer, number one. Valerie's number. You guys had a tremendous amount of hits. Did you foresee any of this, or were you still thinking maybe the architecture? I better keep that in my back pocket. Or
you know, No, I figured by then I was pretty safe. but having said that, I still have a machine shop at home. I still build stuff. It's a huge hobby, I guess, of mine. No, I figured by that time it was pretty pretty well set in stone. However, having said that, I also knew that when a television series goes off the air, then you have to start looking around and considering other things, which I did, and I actually went to the other side of the camera, and I moved to England in the mid-70s, and I became a producer-director. I had always been sort of fascinated by that side of the camera, and I kind of drifted towards that. I knew I wasn't going to get any serious acting jobs after the Monkees. In fact, I went to a couple of interviews after the series went off the air, and they said, "We don't need. What are you doing here? We don't need any drummers." But I was up for instance, I was down to me and Henry Winkler for the Fonz.
How interesting!
And I'm so glad he got it, of course, because he was the perfect Fonz. But he tells the story that he came to the audition, the interview, and he saw me sitting in the waiting room, and he thought, oh, Mickey Dolenz is here. I'm never going to get this. You know,
so. I read that the Monkees episodes were filmed in 3 days per episode. Is that true?
Yes. All series, all 30-minute sitcoms of that era were filmed in 3 days. I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, Flying Nun, whatever.
As a director.
That was the economics of it. You had to do it in 3 days.
Yes, it's incredibly fast. And the studio atmosphere at that time, I mean, you're making personal appearances, you're filming these TV shows, and you're in the studio making, you know, the Monkees put out a lot of music in a short time, an incredible amount of music. You guys must have been going crazy. I mean, you were still 21 years old or something. It must have been a crazy life.
Well, it was an intense life, and it was a lot of work. Contrary to popular belief, there wasn't a whole lot of time to party. So I do remember the 60s because I was working 18 hours a day. I mean, like you say, the normal filming day would have been 10 hours or so, because you had to get there for makeup and wardrobe. And then after that, we would go in the studio, and at times at night recording, I would do 2 or 3 lead vocals in one night.
Because
they needed so much material for the show. And then on the weekends, we immediately started rehearsing. And any spare moment we had, we started rehearsing for the upcoming tours that were being booked.
Let me remind folks, this is WFMU, and we're talking to Mickey Dolenz. You know, you're a busy guy. You are a children's book author. You are a director, an actor, a stage actor. But you are playing with the Monkees on and off your whole life. And it seems like, you know, every time the Monkees kind of just get a little bit out of our consciousness, there's another explosion. The next generation basically, you know, discovers the Monkees. And then the previous generation rediscovers, oh, yes, the Monkees, of course. You do a lot of voiceovers. I believe you're the voice of the fabric softener bear. Is that right?
Was, yeah, a couple of years ago, Snuggles the Bear.
And, of course, you were my competition here, and you worked at CBS-FM in 2005 for 100 shows before they made that wonderful decision to change to the Jack format. That was amazing. But it was fun. That must have been fun, being on the air every morning in, you know, New York City, of all places.
I loved it. I had a great time. It was tough, boy, I'll tell you. People don't realize what a tough job you guys have. It really takes a lot of focus, a lot of concentration. I mean, you only have one of the senses, of the 5 senses to work with, and that's your voice and the audio, and it's very demanding, and especially at that time in the morning.
Oh, please stop, Mickey. Please, please. I'm not that good. Yeah. I appreciate it.
No, people don't realize how tough it is.
Yeah. Let's talk about Davy Jones passed away February 2012.
I'm sorry?
Davy Jones in February 2012. Yeah. That must have, of course, been a surprise. I mean, and I assume your relationship with Davy is like a brother in every way.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That's exactly the way I describe it. It's like losing a sibling. You know, after you spend that much time with someone over the years, and you go through that kind of a roller coaster ride, the closest thing I can describe it is a sibling. I probably spent more time with him, than I did some of my siblings, so because I left home at 18,
yeah.
And we kind of grew up together. You know, we had similar backgrounds because of the child star thing. Also, he and I both got married about the same time, had children about the same time. And so, it's not something I can say I'll ever totally get over. I mean, you just, life has to move on, but he will be sorely missed. And in the upcoming Monkee tour, he will be definitely remembered, and there will be an homage and tribute to him.
Yeah, the Monkees go back and hit the road, and this time Mike is back with the band for the first time, really touring with the band for the first time since the original Monkees, I'm guessing, and it's kind of a big deal.
Not exactly. And he did come on stage with us a few times over the years as sort of a guest thing, like at the Greek Theater or something. But in '97, we recorded an album called Justice, all 4 of us, and Mike joined us for a tour of the UK, a very successful tour of the UK. So it's been about 15 years, I guess. It's been wonderful. We were rehearsing last for the whole last month, actually, just Peter and Michael and I getting tight and revisiting some of his material. We've done a lot of his material over the years, but of course I would sing it or David or Peter would sing it, and it's been wonderful hearing him sing some of his original tunes.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is a new tour. It starts in November and it ends in New York City at the Beacon Theater on December 2nd. And I've put a link to the Monkees website. I've put a link to Mickey's website, which is mickeydolans.com, on the playlist for today's program. And, there's something about the Monkees music that makes it fun and happy and sort of a timeless thing, and it must be great to sort of be a part of something that people just love. It's just a strange, you know, it's not a down thing, it's a completely up thing.
Yeah, it's true, and that there's a lot of elements that account for that, and we've got to start with the most important one in my mind, and that is the songwriters. We were blessed, I was blessed, to have some of the greatest songwriters ever writing for me out of the Brill Building, because that was part of Screen Gems Publishing Music, which was the sister company of the television production company. And so I had Carole King and Jerry Goffin. I had Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart. I had Neil Diamond. I had David Gates. I had, Paul Williams.
Man and Wheel.
Harry Nilsson, Diane Hildebrand, Carol Bayer Sager. I mean,
Harry Nilsson, Chip Douglas.
Harry Nilsson, who had his first hit with the Monkees and then became a very, very dear friend. And, of course, his song Remember is the title track of my new CD, Plug, 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 because I was there when he wrote it. And, in fact, all the songs on the new CD are songs that had some sort of an import in my life, some sort of a reason. They all have a reason to be there. And if you had a chance to look at the liner notes, you'll see. And I mentioned David Gates, for instance. He offered me the diary towards the tail end of the Monkee recordings, and I turned it down because I didn't think I should be doing a ballad, a stupid fool that I was. Because a couple of years later, he comes out with the Bread hit, and I do that on the new CD. Remember. As one of my should-have-done songs.
You were talking about how the new record has a new version of Johnny B. Goode, and we're going to play that in just a minute. But I want to ask you if you could take a time machine and go back in time. There's that moment where the Monkees sort of a little bit of a backlash came, and I think mostly Peter and Mike wanted to take more control musically of what was going on. And you just talked about, you gave a little tribute to all those amazing songwriters and what incredible timing and luck it is to have, you know, song after song after song coming your way. I mean, and people must have been, coming to you first choice of all these great songs because they knew they were going to get on television.
They were writing them specifically for me.
Would you go back in a time machine and try to keep those great songs flowing and not have gotten, or, you know, when the band took control of their own music, would you have not done that?
No, probably not. That's a good question. It's a bit moot because you can't go back and change history. That's just the way it sort of came down. As you say, it was Mike mainly that was spearheading the Palace Revolt, and it was mainly because, you know, he had offered up some of his songs. In fact, in my show, I told the story of him coming up to the producers with some of his material and them saying, you know, this is just not right for the Monkees, sorry, and they took a pass. And this is him telling me this story. And so one of the songs I do in my show, I introduce it, and I say this is the song that the Monkee producers passed on, and Mike gave it to this young up-and-girl singer in Los Angeles at the time named Linda Ronstadt, and we're going to do it now. It's called Different Drum. So I think Mike might have been frustrated that they didn't appreciate or didn't want to, record his stuff, and Peter may be the same. I was not a songwriter at the time, so I was not as concerned, but it wasn't just about that. It was just about we had nothing to say about anything. Not the songs, not who was writing them, not how they were recorded or what was released, or even the album cover, or the liner notes. You know, we just had absolutely nothing to say about it. And so that's really what it was all about. It's just they were putting our names on the album, and we
we kind of felt, well, we ought to have some input here.
Yeah, we're not the Archies. We're not a cartoon character. It's a very odd position to be in. Yeah.
But having said that, like I say, those original songs, you know, are just timeless. And I mean, I just did a tribute album to Carole King 2 years ago, A King for a Day, because she's still one of my favorite writers. Yeah. I do her material in my show all the time. I just did a cover of Sometime in the Morning, which she wrote again. I did it on Remember, because it's such a huge song for me. I did Neil Diamond's I'm a Believer again, if you listen, in sort of an Everly Brothers vibe.
Yeah.
Had a great respect and love for those songs.
This new record is called Remember. It's available at mickeydolenz.com, and it sort of rearranges a lot of songs you think you know, and you've kind of turned them, and in some ways it's very Monkey-ish. You know, like I was thinking, if the Monkees recorded Johnny B. Goode, they would have messed with it a little bit. They wouldn't have let it, they wouldn't have just done a straight-up bar band version of it, and I think your version, it took me a few listens before I sort of really heard the kind of the goofball vibe in it, the kind of that it makes a lot of sense to do what you did to the song, and we're going to hear it in a minute. But first I want to know, what is next beside Monkees Tour? It seems like you never stop. You're in your 60s, but you are not ready to stop. You've got a machine shop in your house, whatever that is. I mean, you're obviously a crazy person. What is next for you?
Well, you know, I like keeping busy. My you know, moving targets harder to hit. My dad always told me, you know, he said, you can't sit around and wait for the phone to ring. So I don't. And, you know, by this time, I've been in virtually every aspect of the business. And so I guess I'm either a dilettante or a renaissance man, depending on your definition of the terms. And I just like keeping busy, and I do have lots of other interests. My big interest right now is continuing in the field of musical theater. I got into it rather late in life, and I just love it. I started out by doing Grease, the national tour of Grease, and on Broadway, and then I did, I did Aida on Broadway in the tour, and then Pippin, and then I did a year over in England doing Hairspray. I'm doing Hairspray in January with the Philharmonic Orchestras of Baltimore and Indianapolis, doing a Philharmonic version of Hairspray. And then I've been offered another show in the UK, and possibly another one here on Broadway. I love doing musical theater. I just really am attracted to it. And in a funny way, if you look back, the Monkees TV show was a little bit of musical theater on television, like an old Marx Brothers movie. In fact, it was John Lennon of the Beatles who made that first comparison. He said the Monkees are like the Marx Brothers. And it's true, the Monkees was like this little musical theater, half-hour Marx Brothers movie with singing and dancing and screwing around and comedy and stuff like that. So musical theater is high on my agenda of stuff to do.
That's what's next. All right. We will see you Beacon Theater December 2nd here in New York City. And
excellent.
And good luck with Remember. It's a sweet album. Let's hear Johnny B. Goode. Anything else we need to hear to know about this recording before we play it?
Wow. Well, I re-envision a couple of things. Randy Scouskit, of course, which was a big hit over in England, the original. Old-fashioned love song Paul Williams gave me, and I didn't get it done in time, so Three Dog Night ripped it out from under my feet. That was another good one. I love Johnny B. Goode, you know, so take a listen to that and tell me what you think.
All right, Mickey Dolenz, thank you so much for joining us. I know you got to catch a plane, so we will talk to you again one of these days.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sitting in the shade. understand it when I said I wanna be your friend. Because a friend could never doubt you or ever put you up tight. And now I wonder what she's doing tonight. Oh yes, I wonder what she's doing tonight. So sad, but I tell myself I didn't lose her. Cause you can't lose a friend you never had.
Come on now.
Because a friend won't say it's over and go out just for spite. And now I wonder